So our reading today is from Acts chapter 17, and it's on the back of the sheets that you got when you came in. Paul then stood up in the meeting of the Areopagus and said, "People of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious. For as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' So you are ignorant of the very thing you worship, and this is what I'm going to proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth, and does not live in temples built by human hands. And he is not served by human hands, as if he needed anything. Rather, he himself gives everyone life and breath and everything else. From one man he made all the nations, that they should inhabit the whole earth, and he marked out their appointed times in history and the boundaries of their lands. God did this so that they would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he is not far from any one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being, as some of your own poets have said, 'We are his offspring.' Therefore, since we are God's offspring, we should not think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image made by human design and skill. In the past, God overlooked such ignorance, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent. For he has set a day when he will judge the world with justice by the man he has appointed. He has given proof of this to everyone by raising him from the dead."
Well, thank you for coming to hear me address this question, "Does science disprove God?" It's a talk I've given many times, actually, in the last 10 years. It may even mean that you've heard it before. But I think it is a necessary subject, just because the atheists are so loud, and the assumption that it does is so commonplace. And so even if you have heard it before, welcome back. And I encourage you to remember some of the things I say and to make the same points to others in your offices. Does science disprove God? I'm going to answer no and argue no, but I would once have said yes. So when I was an undergraduate going up to read natural sciences at Cambridge, I actually wrote a poem to express my contempt for Christians. It wasn't a very good poem because I was studying science, not English, but I do still remember it, and it goes like this. "Some folks seem to find it odd that people grow from tiny cells. Pathetic those who think of God and still drop coins in wishing wells." There we are. That was my contribution to English literature. But you see, I just assumed as an 18-year-old that it must be that there were people who didn't understand the basics of science, the revolution that we'd experienced in the West. I mean, sure, people used to think that God made it rain with a giant watering can in the sky, but then we figured out evaporation and condensation, the water cycle. People used to think that you got ill because of demons and you got better because of miracles, but then we understood about viruses and antibodies, helper T cells, and so on. Surely nowadays, now that we've made such huge strides forward, we've put man on the moon, we've sequenced the human genome, it's time to throw away these superstitions. And people who hadn't done, in my opinion, were like those who threw their money into a well and made a wish and honestly expected tomorrow to turn out differently because of it. They didn't realise, as I did, that the council just comes along once a fortnight and clears out all the change. About 2 months after writing that poem, I became a Christian. And everything in my life changed, including my literary aspirations. So I haven't written a poem the other side of the change. It's a long story. Basically, I met some Christians at university who didn't fit my stereotype of Christians. I would never have been this rude to their face, but basically I thought that Christians were gullible hypocrites. Gullible because I'd never heard reasons why I should believe it. Hypocrites because, well, I read the same headlines that you do about the scandals involving the church. And I met Christians who weren't gullible. They were much more thought out than I was, some of them much more intelligent than me, and neither were they hypocrites. They tried to live out the teaching of Jesus in a way that was very striking in their lives. And that didn't make it true, but it certainly made me curious, And I had lots and lots of arguments and debates, and eventually was persuaded, became a Christian. But at that point, I became one of the things that the modern secularist says that you can't be. I became a both-and person. A scientist, or at least a science student, and a Christian. And again, we're urged that really it has to be either or. I mean, either you can be a rational, logical person and pursue the scientific method, or if you want, for reasons best known to yourself, you can instead be an emotional and imaginative person and take a leap in the dark. But you really can't be both. You can't be logical and a believer in something for which there's no evidence. It's got to be either or, people say. I became both and. And it wasn't just me. It turns out that I was in good company. So some of the great household names of the history of science were both and people. They were scientists and they were devout believers in God. So we'll try this as audience participation. I know you're feeling sleepy in your lunch hour, but see if you know what some of these scientists were famous for. We'll start with an easy one. Isaac Newton, just shout out. Gravity, discover gravity. Michael Faraday.
Electricity,
very good. Louis Pasteur. Pasteurization. He was the one who hypothesized that the reason milk goes off is because of organisms too small to see with the naked eye, which we now know as bacteria. I once asked this question of a load of students. I said, Louis Pasteur, and someone said, milk. And he didn't invent milk, but anyway, he worked out why milk goes off. Charles Babbage. This is very impressive. Computers. James Clerk Maxwell. Maxwell equations in electromagnetism, and so on. All of them, believers in God, and the leading scientists of their day. But you might say, well, isn't that just because of the time they lived in? I mean, people back in the 16th, 17th centuries were generally believers in God. Isn't that why? Well, true. But according to one notable historian of science, he suggests there might be a tighter connection than that. He says it's not by accident that science emerged from a society that believed in God. He put it this way. So Alfred North Whitehead said, "Man sought for law in nature precisely because he believed in a lawgiver." In other words, it was the conviction held by people in the 16th, 17th century that there was an intelligence behind the world that motivated people to try to understand the world intelligibly. If people have believed, as many do today, that the world is purely accidental and random, it's questionable whether they'd have bothered to try to make sense of it in the first place. Both and in the history of science. But what about more recently? So we've made great strides forward in the 20th century. Maybe it's now more difficult, the 21st century. It's now more difficult to believe in God. Well, the first Sunday after I became a Christian, I went to church in Cambridge and sat next to somebody who had a rather professorial-looking beard. And sure enough, it turned out to be Professor Bob White, the Professor of Geophysics at Cambridge. I was quite surprised to find him in a church. Turns out he was one of the leaders of the church. Meanwhile, my next-door neighbour in college was studying geology. He had supervisions with Professor Simon Conway Morris, the paleontologist. And it turned out he was also a Christian. How interesting, because people tell you that you can't believe in the Bible because of the dinosaurs and the geology, and yet Bob White and Simon Conway Morris, between them, know more about those things than most of us do, most people on the planet, actually. And somehow they're both and people. What about genetics? One of my best friends in London is now the reader in evolutionary genomics at Queen Mary University, leading geneticist and a Christian. Or you may know the same year that Richard Dawkins published The God Delusion, Francis Collins, the director of the then Human Genome Project, published his book explaining his faith in Jesus Christ. It doesn't seem to be a simple either-or. Geologist and Christian. Geneticist and Christian. Now, why is that? How is that possible? Have they just thrown their logic away when they go on Sundays to church? I want to suggest it is because there is actually no conflict at all between science and the teaching and miracles and claims of Jesus Christ. I just don't think there is a conflict of any kind. But I need to be careful in definitions at this point, because of course it is possible to define science atheistically so that the only explanations you count as being scientific presuppose atheism, but all you've really done is just cheated in the way you set up the experiment. Let's try and be more objective. What actually is science? Well, science is basically a methodology. It's a way of finding out things about the world, whereby you observe the world, you formulate a hypothesis to describe what you observe, and then you seek to falsify that hypothesis through experiments. There's nothing about that methodology that means you have to be an atheist to use it. Christians can use it, Hindus can use it. In fact, scientific papers don't even bother to distinguish the faith position of their authors, because it doesn't matter, because it's the same experiment done whether you're a Muslim or Hindu or Christian or an atheist. And the methodology is not intrinsically atheistic. Nor, as far as I know, are any of the results of that methodology, anything we've discovered using science, in conflict with the Bible or Jesus Christ. I just don't think there is a conflict of that kind. But pretty obviously, there is a conflict somewhere. Otherwise, you probably wouldn't have turned out this lunchtime to hear this talk. I want to suggest, though, that the conflict is located somewhere else. It's a conflict not between science and Jesus, but rather it's a conflict between two different philosophies, two different worldviews. If I can be provocative, I'd say two different faiths. It makes atheists quite angry if you call atheism a faith. And yet it is interesting, as you read a book like The God Delusion, how often Richard Dawkins will assert things for which he doesn't give scientific data. It is, I would say, quite a creedal book. So there are these two positions that you can hold: atheism, Christianity, others beside, we won't talk about this lunchtime. And science is just a methodology that we both use and provides results that we both accept. But what I want to do in the time we've got remaining is to describe these two philosophies and then to do what any responsible scientist should do and ask which one makes most sense of the evidence. So here they are briefly. We'll start with atheism. Atheism, or naturalism, is a philosophy that says that matter and chance is all that there is. So in the words of Bertrand Russell, the great British philosopher, mankind is nothing but a chance collocation of atoms on a minor speck of interstellar dust. Well, as a scientist, of course, we all agree with him that we are made up of atoms and that the Earth is not a particularly large planetary body in a vast galaxy, one of many, many galaxies. But the key words are, for Bertrand Russell, we are nothing but, that is all that we are. Or in the words of Francis Crick, he was the guy who got the Nobel Prize, well, with two others, for getting the double helix structure of DNA. Later went on to be a neuroscientist in my own field. He writes this. He says, he puts it in inverted commas, because he's not sure how much the concept of personality really makes sense, but the apparent you, your joys and your sorrows, your sense of personal identity and free will, are in fact, he says, no more than the behaviour of a vast assembly of nerve cells and their associated molecules. Now again, as a neuroscientist, I agree with him that your thoughts are bound up with the movement of electrons in your brain. But the key words are no more than. That is all that you are. You're reducible to that. There's only matter and chance, and everything else is reducible to those things. That's atheism. Well, Christianity, the Christian view, is very, very different. And I want to refer you again to the reading that we heard. This is a speech given by the Apostle Paul in 1st century Athens. We're told he got speaking to some Epicurean philosophers. Epicureans are a little bit like today's naturalists or atheists. They didn't believe that the gods played any role in human life. They thought there was no survival beyond death. And this is how Paul explains the Christian view of the world in contrast to theirs. And I'm going to read again just the beginning of the second paragraph. The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth and does not live in temples built by human hands. He's not served by human hands as if he needed anything. Rather, he himself gives everyone life and breath and everything else. I wonder if you can see just from one or two sentences of his speech that in some ways Christianity and atheism are precisely the opposite of each other. Let me explain what I mean. If you said to an atheist, does God exist? He or she would say, no, or probably not. Probably not is the more recent trendy way of saying no. But if you said to an atheist, does Christianity exist? She would say, well, of course. You know, I'm not ignorant of the fact that more than a billion people in the world worship God. Well, can you explain where Christianity came from? Of course, she'd say. People made it up. So for atheists, random chance creates a human being, and a human being in our imagination creates God. So God is our idea. We think up God. And Paul says that is precisely the opposite of the case. The world begins with God, and he thinks up us. But being as his God and much more powerful, we're not just an idea, we're something he's able to bring into being. And that is why we're here today. So two very, very different views. Let's now look at the science and see which of these views does it make more sense of. I'm going to compare them in three ways. The first one's longest, and I'm going to get quicker and then I'm done. Number one, which one makes most sense of design? Now, this is a very contentious word, because, of course, not everyone believes that the world has been designed. But everyone at least concedes that the world has the appearance of design. Sir Fred Hoyle, the astronomer, once said that the idea of life as we know it emerging by accident out of a primordial soup just seemed to him astonishingly unlikely. And he once said it's a bit like saying a whirlwind passed through a junkyard and left behind a fully functioning 747 aircraft. I mean, it's just about theoretically possible that all the bits of junkyard should happen to blow together into exactly the right array to be an aircraft that you could start up and fly to America. But just it doesn't seem intuitively very likely that that's where the aircraft came from. Well, according to atheists like Dawkins, we have an explanation for it. Here's a quote from his book, The Blind Watchmaker, which was required reading when I went up to Cambridge all those years ago. He says this: design, in inverted commas, design is only apparent. We have a mechanism to account for it, natural selection, the blind, unconscious, automatic process, which we now know is the explanation for the existence of and apparently purposeful form of all life, has no purpose in mind. It has no mind, no vision, no foresight, no sight at all. If it can be said to play the role of watchmaker in nature, it is that of the blind watchmaker. So according to Richard Dawkins, yes, the world looks designed, but design is just a trick played on us by a random, mechanical, impersonal process that can explain everything that we see. And I want to take issue with that. I don't particularly want to go into the questions of evolution, although ask me afterwards if you want to. But suffice to say that even if you accept that natural selection, evolution, is all that you need to get from a single-celled ancestor billions of years ago to a self-conscious human being sitting in this room. And it's worth saying that goes way beyond anything that's been remotely established scientifically. But even if you accept that, you've still got a problem. Because even to get evolution started, you first have to have information-carrying, self-replicating molecules. The simplest we know of is RNA, which is one of the most complex chemicals known to modern chemistry. And you have to have the information on that strand of RNA required to build even the simplest self-replicating cell. That's even before you can have any evolution, let alone explain away a human being. Where did that come from? And actually, the problems get even bigger because you also have to have a universe for that RNA to exist in. The science tells us this is quite tricky. Let me make two quick arguments. Number one, it's known as the Kalam cosmological argument, which I love because it sounds a bit like a sort of superhero franchise. Kapow, Kasham, Kalam. It's called the Kalam cosmological argument. It simply goes like this. Everything that begins to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist, at least according to the Big Bang theory. Therefore, the universe has a cause. It's a very simple argument. Basically, it's just saying you don't need to explain things that don't change. Things that have always existed, you don't have to explain. Like if I were to ask the question, you know, how come that mug is still there at this point in my talk. It's not a very interesting question. It's there because it was there. It's just still there. Nothing's happened to the mug. It's just there. But if something were to happen, like the mug were to suddenly move down onto the floor, and someone said, "Oh, how come the mug that used to be there is now there?" I said, "Oh, I don't know. It just happened." That wouldn't be a very satisfying scientific answer. Because something to have moved or changed, I'm expecting a cause that changed it. Well, you apply this to God. Why is God there? Well, he's always been there. He's there now because he was there before. Why was he there before? Well, he was there before that. So you don't have to explain things that don't change. He's just always been there. But why is the universe there? Well, people used to think the universe had been around forever, so you didn't need to explain it. But in the last 100 years, the consensus of the scientific community is that the universe has a beginning in the finite past, a Big Bang singularity. So why did it begin? Why did it not used to be there and now it is there? What made the Big Bang go bang? The atheist, it's a problem, you see. There's nothing beyond it to make it happen. Whereas the Christian has had the answer for more than 3,000 years. In the beginning, God created. The God who's always been there decided to make the universe there. Makes perfect sense. It's a headache. The Big Bang theory is a big headache for an atheist. But not only did the Big Bang have to go bang, someone had to make it start, but also the Big Bang had to go bang at exactly the right speed. I love this argument. And so the physicists tell us that the expansion rate of the universe in the first phase of its life had to be exactly right. If the universe expanded too quickly, all you would get would be hydrogen atoms, just infinitely spread out, or very, very spread out. No planets, no other elements, no human beings, just gas. On the other hand, if the universe expanded too slowly, then gravity would overcome it and suck it back into itself. So you get a big bang and then a big crunch, a universe and then no universe again, even before you got to 1 millisecond on your stopwatch. To get any kind of universe of the kind that we live in, that lasts for longer than a millisecond and has stuff other than hydrogen gas, the expansion rate of the universe has got to be correct to within 1 part in 10 to the 40. 1 in 10 with 40 zeros on the end. This is, by the way, these are not special Christian numbers. These are mainstream physicist numbers. If you want an analogy, it's a bit like taking a continent the size of America, covering it with 5 penny pieces, stacking them to a distance between here and the moon, 380,000 kilometres away. I'm doing the same for a billion other continents the same size, painting one of them red with nail varnish, blindfolding your husband, getting him to pick one at random. That would be about 1 in 10 to the 40. In other words, it is very, 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 very unlikely. And the atheist has to say, well, it got lucky. And the Christian says, that's too lucky. It looks like someone chose the numbers and got them right. Which one makes most sense? This is just the numbers that science is giving us, Big Bang theory, expansion rate of the Big Bang, and yet they don't fit the atheist philosophy very well at all. And they fit the Christian philosophy very well indeed. Second comparison, and I'll say these two are quicker. What about human life and existence? What about us? Now, don't mishear me here. I'm not arguing that Christianity must be true because it's nicer, although it is nicer. But rather, I want to just challenge anybody here who's an atheist, sort of comfortably, about the problem when you don't live by the thing that you believe. I used to really hate hypocrisy when I was an atheist. I hated religious hypocrisy. And if you hate religious hypocrisy, you're in good company, because Jesus Christ couldn't stand it either. Some of his most sharp rebukes are reserved for religious people who don't live out what they say. But I never noticed when I was an atheist that I was guilty of hypocrisy, because I didn't live out what I say. I didn't live in a way that was consistent with what I said I believed about the world. Let me explain. John Gray, the emeritus professor of European thought at the London School of Economics, published a book called Straw Dogs, in which he says that mankind must accept that we're no different from any other species in being a lucky throw in the cosmic lottery. He says we find this reality hard to accept. We must realise that we live in a universe that is as indifferent to our hopes as it is to our sufferings and our crimes. And his point is simply this. If you're going to be consistent about your view of the world, you've got to realise the world's random. And if the world is random, the world does not care. If you suffer, it's random. If a friend dies, it's random. There's no point in looking for meaning or crying out why. There is none. It's all just indifferent, impersonal numbers, chance. So I remember speaking to one of the professors when I was doing my PhD. And we used to sort of have a bit of banter, and I got a hard time for being the Christian guy in the laboratory. And one day I said to her, in jest, I need to explain that, I said to her, Kate, according to your philosophy, why would killing you be wrong? I know with hindsight it sounds like you're chilling, doesn't it? But this was just a thought experiment. She was smiling and we were... But why would it be any different to just cutting a grapefruit in half for my breakfast? Because all I would be doing in both cases is just rearranging the atoms of the universe in a slightly different way. Kate atoms, grapefruit atoms, much the same proportion of carbon and so on. And what's the difference? She thought about it for a moment. She said, the difference is my mother would be upset. I said, but Kate, what's upset? Upset is just a decrease in the concentration of serotonin in the randomly assembled collection of atoms, which is your mother's brain. Why does it matter? And she couldn't tell me why it mattered. Of course, we both knew that it did matter. Kate was not an amoral person. She didn't live as though life were random or as if human life were cheap. The point is that she couldn't ground her sense that humanity matters in a philosophy that tells us that at rock bottom everything is impersonal. I mean, sure, you might say, well, it's because we've evolved sociology so that we care about each other. Yeah, but the trouble is it reduces to something that doesn't care. Sociology reduces to neuroscience, because sociology is just a product of a lot of brains in a room. So the neuroscience department wants the budget from the sociology department, please. But then neuroscience reduces to chemistry, because brains are just collections of chemicals, and chemistry reduces to physics, because chemicals have the properties they do because of the underlying particles. And so all the budget goes to the physics department, and they build another particle accelerator at the cost of billions of pounds. But the point is, everything reduces to something that doesn't care. Sociology reducible to psychology, reducible to biology, reducible to physics, reducible to numbers, reducible to impersonal chance. Doesn't care. And my point is that no atheist that I've ever met lives as though that were the case. And that's a problem. If you assert a philosophy that you can't live by, that's a hypocrisy. Whereas the Bible explains that we matter because we're made by God, who thinks we matter. In fact, he has a purpose for us. Look down at the bottom of the second paragraph. God did this. God made us and determined where we should live. He did this so that they would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he's not far from any one of us. God made us to know him. A God who is personal. A God who distinguishes between what is good and what is evil. A God who's generous. A God who loves truth. And so that sense that we have in us, that generosity matters and that human life is valuable and that truth is better than lies, it makes sense in this philosophy. But very difficult for atheism to account for any of those things. Number one, design. Number two, human life. Number three, more briefly, which philosophy makes most sense of Jesus Christ? Because here's the problem. If we wanted to get to know God, and all you had to go on was data from science, what could you find out? I mean, let's imagine you wanted to get to know me. Maybe you don't after this talk, but imagine you do. And all you've got to go on is what you can find out by experiments. So here I am. I consent to most of your experiments. What do you want to do? Well, you could do gas chromatography under my armpit and work out what deodorant I'm wearing and whether it's coping with the slightly stressful situation I'm finding myself in. You could take a DNA sample and tell me if I'm on the Interpol wanted database or whether I'm likely to die early from any known genetic illness. Actually, I am. My grandfather and my great-grandfather both died of heart attacks in their 50s. That's about all you could tell. You wouldn't be able to tell my name. You couldn't tell really anything of importance to me as a person, who I love, what makes me laugh, what makes me cry, what I would die for. only very superficial things, which is why, if any of you here is in a relationship, I very much doubt that on the first date you said, please can I take a small scratching of cells from the inside of your cheek to run some DNA tests, and I'll be back with an answer in a couple of weeks. It's not how it works, is it? That science is very powerful, but it doesn't tell you everything that's important. And when it comes to getting to know people, science is quite limited. And that's even somebody sitting across from you in a room. What about if you wanted to get to know a person that you can't see? If God is everywhere, how do you exclude him from the universe to take a null reading as a control? God, please could you just leave for a moment so we can compare the readings between a universe with you in it and one where you're not here? You just can't do that kind of experiment. You just can't find out unless God decided to take the initiative to make himself known to us. And that's where Paul finishes his speech in Athens. Last paragraph. Verse 30. In the past, God overlooked our ignorance, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent. It means to change their minds. He has set a day when he will judge the world with justice by the man he's appointed. He has given proof of this to everyone by raising him from the dead. What a surprise that was to me as a non-Christian to find that word in the Bible. The word proof. So I always thought that religion was about things you felt and things you like to be true, whereas science was about facts and evidence. Now I know the Bible better. I know that the Bible never asks you to believe anything without giving you a reason first. How surprising to discover there was evidence why I should change my mind. And the evidence that Paul cites is the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. This is God wanting to get to know us, saying, this is what I'm really like. Time to change your mind about me. Now, I looked at the resurrection of Jesus in the index for the God Delusion. I read the whole thing, but I was just checking it up again earlier today. And I discovered it's mentioned only once. And Richard Dawkins says that the resurrection of Jesus can't have happened because it's in its very nature contrary to the principles of science. But actually, that isn't how science works. Science doesn't decide a theory and then reject the bit of data that doesn't fit the theory. In fact, the bit of data that doesn't fit the theory is usually the key to the scientific advance, where you change your theory. A more open-minded scientist ought to think resurrections don't fit within an atheistic world. Only a God of such power that he made the world would have power to raise somebody from the dead. Maybe it's time to change my mind, because the Christian worldview makes so much more sense of the science than the atheist one. Thank you for listening. Simon's standing up, which means you're over your time, so he's... But thank you for your patience with me.